Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. A dozen plus Massachusetts elected officials are publicly condemning the Biden administration's treatment of Haitian immigrants seeking shelter in the U.S., calling it barbaric and reprehensible. This after shocking images emerged of U.S. Border Patrol agents in Texas on horseback pushing Haitian migrants back into the Rio Grande. Then news this morning that the U.S. Special Envoy for Haiti, Daniel Foote, is abruptly resigning. He says he refuses to be associated with the United States' quote, inhumane, counterproductive decision to deport thousands of Haitian refugees, unquote. All this news touches deeply here in Massachusetts, home of the third largest Haitian community in the country. So we turn now to Marie St. Fleur, a former Massachusetts state representative and the first Haitian American elected to state office in the U.S. She's now a principal at St. Fleur Communications and a friend of the show. Marie, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's good to be with you, Tiziana.
Marie, how are you?
Extremely sad. Sad for the people of the Haitian migrants who find themselves in this untenable position, and sad for our country. Our country is supposed to be, America is supposed to be that beacon on a hill that invited all those tired masses, and that we would have a process, a humane process, to determine how they come permanently into our country. And what I saw yesterday, particularly the inhumane treatment of government officials, American government officials, on horseback, reminiscent of the times when you were chasing runaway slaves, because that's who you were chasing, were Black people, using their reins as whip to commit assault and battery on Haitian migrants who have for months walked, struggled to get to a place where they thought they could be safe. It's beyond painful.
I'm wondering, Marie, you said city on a hill. You talked about what the United States should be. When you see what you saw yesterday, what do you think we are instead?
I think that we are falling into the worst of us, into a dark past that we thought we had come through and rejected. And we need to stop and really think about who we are. Because I think that we are going down this slippery slope. We've been going down that slippery slope now, for over 5 years. And yesterday tells me that there's a cancer in our country that we need to rip out, and we need to do it quickly.
Marie, I want to ask you, you talked about the assault and battery you saw in those photos. We know, the U.S. government is investigating that. Is there any possibility that it turns out it's not what it looks like?
Well, I don't know. I think when the American government can show me pictures of any other group of people that they have corralled using horses, allowing the Border Patrol to get on horses and corral them in the fashion that they've been doing, then perhaps my eyes, we could say what was, we're always saying that the tape is wrong, that what we think we see is not what we see. No, what we're seeing is what we're seeing. They're on horses. They're chasing these Black people, period. That is indisputable.
What are you hearing from the Haitian community in Greater Boston these last few days, Marie?
They're outraged. They're hurt. I have people, and the reason why I know it's true, I have folks down at that board in Texas right now in Del Rio, the chair of the National Haitian American Elected Officials Network, which was an organization that I launched before I left office. They're down there. And the guy was in tears. We were on phone with the White House yesterday, and they were in tears. They were in tears because of what they've observed, of people being just dropped off at bus stations without any resources, people being left to sleep on the street in a rural town where they know no one, where they don't speak the language. So we're outraged as a community. Anybody who believes that we are better than this should be outraged. And anyone who is pro-life, who believes in humanity, should be outraged. you know, that human beings are being treated once again like cattle under the banner of the United States Constitution.
What did you say to the White House yesterday, and what did they tell you?
They told us that it's indefensible what happened, that it's being investigated, that they are looking to create a surge to provide support and resources to address the humanitarian crisis that exists under that exists in Del Rio, Texas. And so we're waiting to see what that will look like. And the chairman was, we're waiting to see what Mayorkas has to say. And we're looking to see how the processing of these migrants who were simply looking for a place to be safe. I mean, they're running for their lives, and they saw America as the place where they could find safety. And yes, we could treat them better, and we should treat them better. We were outraged when Italy was doing it. We were outraged when France was doing it. And here we are repeating the same mistake.
So a couple things to clarify there. When you say Mayorkas, you mean Alejandro Mayorkas, Secretary of Homeland Security. Was he on the call yesterday? Was it his office?
No, it was. There were representatives from Homeland Security. There were representatives from their Biden's engagement. And so Mayorkas is having had a conversation with the chairman of NEON. And we hope and we expect that he will confirm, one, that the surge that they talk about in resources is in fact underway and will occur, that the issue of dropping people off at a bus stop would cease, and that there would be more attempts to make certain that we bring in and different infrastructure to support the processing of these individuals in a humane way. We have Haitian American nurses. We have Haitian American attorneys. We have translators who are ready to go and be supportive, but they need an infrastructure to so that they could, when they get there, they can do the job. They can have access to the migrants. And so we need to understand what that process is.
And did you get any sense in the conversation with the administration yesterday, Marie, about teeth in this investigation? I am struck by the fact that the U.S. government said to you yesterday, this is unacceptable, but it was agents of the U.S. government that were doing the thing that they said was unacceptable.
Yes, and they're investigating it.
That's a heavy sigh, Marie. As you say that, are you skeptical?
Well, listen, I at this point, I am skeptical about everything. Until I see real action, I'm skeptical. You know, that they're being treated that way and by us, it leaves me skeptical. So I wait to see what the outcomes of any investigation is, how it's handled. And in terms of the Haitian American community, our demand is that the forced expulsion stop.
What do you say in response to those who would say, we have refugees coming from Haiti, Afghanistan, Central America, Ethiopia. It is a crush of new arrivals, and we don't have the capacity.
Yeah, well, that's what France has said. That's what Italy has said. And we have said, figure it out. And so I say the same thing to us, figure it out. Because this crisis that we're talking about, that where the Haitian migrants are at the center, is a humanitarian crisis that speaks of the displacement of thousands of people around the world. It is an issue that we're going to have to face as a human community. And America must lead, because as a nation of immigrants, we are at the center of being able to model, articulate the way that we lead in order to make certain that everyone has an opportunity to have a safe passage. And we do have a process that used to work. We need to put it back in place. It was ripped out by the prior administration. We need to put it back into place so that we honor our constitutional duty, where we say that everyone has equal protection under the law, where everyone has the right to due process once they have set foot on American soil, that we are a nation of laws and not a nation of men, and that those laws should be protected and really followed.
Marie, let's accompany a family that's been trying to cross the Rio Grande for a minute. If they are sent back to Haiti, what do they face there?
one, if most of them probably, particularly if they're children, they probably have not been in that country, because some of them, if you look at the babies, they were necessarily born in that country. So they have no idea, right? They probably trying to figure out, you're going into a country right now that is trying to recover from an earthquake that was, what, 7.0, that destroyed a certain region in the country, where we still, as I understand it, are trying to figure out how to get bodies from out from under debris, because they don't have the capacity or the appropriate equipment to do that. You have a country where the president was recently assassinated, and that there's an investigation, and that has not been resolved, and that there is issues around the lack of security, because that it's being overrun by gang, and that there is no real police or public safety security. You have a country that has over 90% unemployment and does not have any real industry in order to support the people who currently reside there. Okay, that's on top of the fact that we have this a country that has been trying to recover from a 2010 earthquake. You know, just like in Louisiana, where we have the Ninth Ward, where even today we still have people who have not yet recovered, yet we have all the resources in the world to make that happen. So imagine a country that does not even have a tenth of what we have here, trying to recover from all of that. And now you want to take 13,000 or however the number of people are and just fly them into that country and say, here, figure it out. I'm going to give you some money, by the way. I'm going to help you figure out how to get them jobs. What jobs? You know, that's the mess that you're trying to say, okay, people, let's send them back into. And so what are we doing?
So, Marie, let's stay with that for a minute. I was thinking back today of the 2010 quake and the massive mobilization in the city that we were all engaged in after that. You know, this quake in August was 7.2 magnitude. This is a month after the assassination of Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse. We talked with you at that time. Now we're talking about movement of thousands of people being deported back. It is a combination of a, it's complex, right? It's a combination of a man-made disaster and a natural disaster. How do you want, I'm remembering the mobilization in 2010 in Greater Boston. How do you want the Greater Boston community to mobilize today?
Well, I think that we need their help. We need their voices. We need them to lift up their voices and speak to this humanitarian crisis, and to say that these folks have been, who are fleeing, whether they were coming from, they weren't coming from Haiti. Many of them were coming from Brazil, Chile, Peru. They're fleeing some combination of oppression, and they're looking at America to be able to support. So we need to say that is who we are. That's all we've always been. That's how many of us got here, was fleeing some sort of oppression. And then we're able to build a family and root our family in this amazing place that we want to be, that in terms of who we want to be as Americans. I want them to lift their voices about the injustice. If you believe that human beings have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, then lift your voice. And then I want to say, if there's any way you can support any of these individuals in any way, because, you know, they're children, young children here, who are going to need a home. They're going to be folks who are going to need a way to be able to rebuild their lives. And so please, if you have a way of making a call into the White House today to say stop this inhumane and immoral treatment, please make that call today.
Marie St. Fleur, a former Massachusetts state representative, now a principal at St. Fleur Communications. Marie, my thoughts are with you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Tiziana.
We've talked quite a bit here on the show about the unfolding crisis that's captured as mass and cast, where substance use disorder and homelessness intersect and where conditions have deteriorated rapidly in the last several months. Now, one organization, the Greater Boston Food Bank, sits both literally and figuratively at that intersection. Their headquarters are in the neighborhood, where, as the region's largest hunger relief organization and with 120 employees plus volunteers, they're a big presence. They're also an organization whose mission is to serve the state's most vulnerable, in their case, by addressing hunger. Food Bank President Catherine D'Amato has grown increasingly vocal about her concerns over conditions in the area, which is also known as the New Market Business District. And Catherine joins us now. Catherine, welcome back.
Thank you, Tiziana, for having me.
So briefly, Catherine, paint a picture for us. How bad is it there?
Well, it's deplorable and tragic, and it's a human tragedy, right? We have people who need help, and they may not be choosing to go into shelter or seek services involving addiction. So there are quite a few folks who are on the street, and they have secured tents and are living on the sidewalks, and they are living also, sometimes right in the street. And, for example, right now it's all around our parking lot and attached to our fencing, so our team members have to go in and out of that space. So it's very dangerous, and it's dangerous because it's an industrial commercial area. I mean, also you have tractors and trailers and big trucks, and very tenuous for anyone that would find themselves needing to live on the street.
So let's talk about that danger for a minute. You've just, I think, sort of underscored with tractors and trailers around and people on the streets, that danger is obvious. You've also raised some concerns about employee safety. Have you had incidents around employee safety?
Well, we've had a situation, I'll speak for myself, where, somebody hits my car or does, is so high to can. I mean, they are so not in touch with who they are or where they are, whether that's in the middle of the street or on the sidewalk. They fall over. They're completely out. It's almost like they're unconscious, right? So that's occurring, and you can have a situation. We've encouraged our team members to use what is called Moore Street, which is a private way. There are only three entrances into the Greater Boston Food Bank, and they are each one block: Atkinson, Topeka, and Moore. Moore is the private way. Atkinson is where the shelter is. There's enormous activity there all the time, in and out.
So
Topeka is what we've been using, and it's very difficult to get in and out.
So, there's a tension in this, Catherine. One of the reasons that I wanted to talk to you was this tension between your needs as essentially a local business and a local employer with work to do, and the core mission of supporting the most vulnerable who are there at Mass and Cass. How are you thinking about that tension? How are you talking about it inside your organization?
Well, our team is very empathetic, and we understand that people need help, and they deserve the help that can be given to them with wraparound services and from the city of Boston and the state. And there are great partners in our neighborhood that that are excellent at emergency housing and shelter and addiction and all kinds of behavioral health. And they are doing the work. They are doing that work, and I applaud them, and I'm there with them. In order for us to get food in and out, which is our core mission to feed the hungry, we need clear passage and we need some containment. One has to take a look at this seriously. This is, we care. We have care and concern, but we do not, we're not the authority for the city of Boston. We don't have responsibility over the street of Boston, over the sidewalk of Boston. We want to make sure that our team members and visitors are safe coming, and we want to make sure that the people who find themselves right now in this tent city in Boston are able to be placed and get services should they so choose, right? There's also free will here, and that's an important factor. People need to get the services, and I know my colleagues are here helping and willing to continue to help.
Are you in conversation with the city and with Acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey?
I am not. We have reached out to her in June with a letter, and our board sent another letter early September. We have hopefully another letter will go today or tomorrow, and it's partly why I decided to talk to the media and help the Newmarket Business Association be able to bring its story forward, because it isn't just the Greater Boston Food Bank. It's many businesses in Newmarket that have destruction of property, have inability to get in and out of their businesses, have garbage, have defecation, human waste. These are, and fear that they're going to hurt someone accidentally, or a member of their own team, or, a visitor could find themselves at risk.
How about the candidates, Michelle Wu and Anissa Asaibi George for Boston Mayor? Have they been in dialogue with you? Have you made requests of them?
Yeah, we have had some dialogue, and I think that that all the candidates, I have not had any dialogue with Mayor Janney, so that personally I have not. She did visit Newmarket as a candidate. I was not on that visit. And I believe that it's an important question of when we will ask these two electoral candidates to commit to designing and implementing a collaborative plan to within the first 50 and 100 days in order to keep Newmarket businesses open and to keep, you know, the services that are so needed for these, this particular population that is deeply hurting.
So talk briefly, Catherine. You have said elsewhere, including to WBUR's Deb Becker, about the expenses that your organization has undertaken to increase clear pathway for your trucks, safety for people on the streets as well as your employees. Talk about those costs and how they impact your mission.
Sure. So we now have 5 security guards. That's about $550,000 annually, 3 during the day and 2 overnight. And then we have also had to put up new steel fencing because the other fencing was destroyed. Chain link fence was easier to get through, and we had encampments on our property and behind our building. We have had that for a long time, so we put in better fencing. We have put in gates that close during the day, so that individuals cannot come in and sort of wander around on the property and, again, be at risk in being injured in some way. And we've replaced cameras that were destroyed and vandalized and had to clean up graffiti and had to clean up garbage. So we've spent another $500,000 to do that. So it's
That's $1 million, Catherine.
That's $1 million, and we can provide 2 meals for $1. So that's 1 million meals. Now, I understand the significance. We are deeply committed to continuing our service. But in order to continue our service, I need to make sure there is a level of safety for those that need our help. And that in order for us to serve the communities of Eastern Massachusetts, 190 cities and towns, Boston being the largest, we need to be able to move food in and out. And large, hundreds of visitors a day. And so we have trucks, we have tractor trailers, we have pallets, we have, businesses coming in and out, vendors, to be able to bring this necessary food. So this is, just a huge challenge. And I understand that. I understand that it takes collaboration and coordination, but I also understand that the city has multiple services it can pull forward. The Department of Public Works to clean up, the city, the police department, to be able to provide some containment and some level of making sure people have passage, that cars can get through, that trucks can get through, that people are safe. If they're living on the sidewalk, they need to be safe.
All right. That is Catherine D'Amato, president and CEO of the Greater Boston Food Bank, talking about Mass and Cast, which we will continue to follow here on Radio Boston. Catherine, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
John Barrows has run for Boston mayor twice. The first time in 2013, he received an endorsement from the Boston Globe before the preliminary election in a wide-open race. He did not advance to the general. After serving as the city's chief of economic development under the candidate who did win, Marty Walsh, he entered the fray again this year, and that bid ended last Tuesday. Now a woman will be the next mayor of Boston, and a woman of color. But we will not have a black mayor, despite 3 black candidates before the preliminary. There is so much to unpack in this race, and so much at stake for the city. And John joins us now to reflect on all of it. John Barrows, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Tiziana, thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
It's great to have you back. John, I got to tell you, this is one of those days where I wish we could be face-to-face, maybe with a cup of coffee or something a little stronger. And, while we talk this through, and I just want to start by saying, okay, it's a week out. How you doing? How you feeling?
Well, I rediscovered this thing called sleep. It's amazing. You actually close your eyes and not just spend the whole time thinking about things and solving problems. You could actually get some rest. But I'm feeling good. Feeling good right now.
Did you sleep those first couple nights after the preliminary?
No, I didn't. You know, the whole time you're thinking about what happened, what we could have done, how we did, who you should call, who you have to thank, you know, how grateful you are for the experience, for the people who supported you, and for the conversations we had.
So, of course, you just listed all the questions that I want to ask you. What happened? What did you, could you have done differently? Who should you call? You know, let's start at what do you feel good about and what do you wish you'd done differently in this candidacy?
Yeah, you know, so I feel great about the ideas that came out. The, you know, my education plan was something that I worked on with a lot of different educators, school leaders, talking to people back and forth, what they were experiencing, what they saw, what we should be able to do. And at the end of this, I came out big with a huge investment goal because we need to do it. We can do it. Buildings matter. Facilities matter. But it also does only because you design them to support the programming and the curriculum. I was really excited about that. Also excited, you know, very early on, heard from men of color, Black men particularly, about wanting to be part of this conversation, want to be part of the history, want to be part of the excitement. And so the, you know, got a lot of positive feedback from the Black men roundtables we put on. It's something that I want to continue to do, just got to try to figure out how to do it. But feel good about the race, the ideas we put out, and the tables we set up.
Do you think there's a particular issue or a proposal where you made a particular mark, like the direction that the city will go, the policies that the remaining candidates will pick up, were bent in a direction you wanted to send it?
Yeah, I do. I feel like we contributed, and those ideas will last. The priority areas we pushed had an impact. And I know because I sat with both of the finalists, and in those conversations, they reflected that we had an impact on them. And that we would have an impact on how they set up their administration and some of the things they do.
So let's talk about the tough conversation that's happening in the city around the fact that there's not a Black candidate in the final, John, and the tension between those who believe that you, Acting Mayor Janey, Councilor Andrea Campbell, split a vote, and those who say, we never say there are too many white people in a race. Why are we talking about splitting a Black vote here? Is it some of both? Is it one? Is it the other? Did you have a role to play in that? I mean, this is a moment of real reflection.
No, I've always been one to believe that good candidates in the democratic process helps to strengthen our process, helps to strengthen government, helps to strengthen the ideas, the policies that are discussed. And then let's face it, Tiziana, I had, you know, all my voters weren't Black. All of Kim's voters weren't Black. All of Andrea's voters weren't Black. The communities don't vote in that kind of monolithic way. It's not that we came in and we said, hey, how many Black votes can we get to win? Because in fact, any single candidate getting all the Black votes couldn't do it, right? So let's start there. This has to be a race where the candidate comes in, appeals to multiple communities, multiple racial backgrounds, ethnicities, religious orientations. You have to be a candidate that's going to be the mayor for the city of Boston, not one community. And so I think having strong candidates is a plus for our city, not a minus.
I was really struck last Friday. You may know that we do this thing called Week in Review on Friday, where we look back at the week. Last week on Friday, we had Marie Frances Rivera of Mass Budget and Policy Center and Jim Sturgis of the Pioneer Institute. When I asked them sort of what's the headline from the preliminary last Tuesday, they both went straight to voter turnout. And that, I thought that was interesting. And I hear you say, like you're not surprised. What is the voter turnout story from last Tuesday? And what's the lesson to learn from that, John?
Yeah, I'm not surprised. That is a fact. I think the number one thing, the voter turnout was so low. It was slower than I had feared. I was paying attention to other municipal races across the country. And in fact, voter turnout had been low in different cities. And I was hoping we can create enough excitement here in Boston and it being a historic field with change on the horizon, and people can get excited. But it didn't happen that way.
Why, John? I mean, if people can't get excited about the first time there's not a white male even on the ticket, let alone going to be mayor of Boston, and you've got this incredibly, I mean, the five of you are non-corrupt, dedicated, smart policymakers with proven track records who care about the city. If the city can't get excited about that, what's it going to take?
Well, you know what I heard too often was, oh, great candidates. And, you know, almost like any one of you can be mayor. Kind of like what you just said.
Right? Fair enough.
Like, I felt like we needed like someone who people were scared to, you know, elect, right? I feel like we needed a reason for people to come out. Too many conversations were about the fact that this was a historic field of strong candidates. And I think who knows, maybe that was too comforting for some people and they decided to sit it up.
They thought we'd be okay no matter what.
Yeah.
So I wasn't planning on asking you this, but it's in my head. I'm going to ask you this. I was thinking a lot during this race. So, you know, I taught at the Boston College School of Social Work. And, John, we taught about you in one of the documentaries in our class from your youth organizing at DSNI. You know, there you are on the screen as a 16-year-old. We're teaching young social workers about you. You led DSNI. The country knows about the work there. You have this deep experience as the chief of economic development for the city. You are a strong black man twice in the race. Why do you think you couldn't get the traction that all of that could bring to the table in the mayoralty?
Well, first, let me just say, proud of the work that you and I did together in the neighborhoods, too. I mean, you left that part out.
Thank you.
You led some important work there. You know, I think, in all my conversations, not once did someone say, hey, John, I just don't think you have the experience to be a good mayor, or I just don't think you can make it happen. I mean, in fact, in 2013, when I ran, people said, hey, those are some cool things you've done. You think you can be mayor? Do you think you can run a $4 billion, at that point, $2.7 billion operation? This time, there was none of that, right? People thought I had the experience. But what I couldn't, I think, break out of was the history people were excited to set was in fact a woman, particularly a woman of color, being mayor. And I could never break out of that. And people were just excited about that. And you've got to be excited about that. There's a lot to be excited about. I continue to have good conversations. I continue to pass the muster for somebody who people would elect. But ultimately, Boston wanted a mayor of color. It was really clear, and it's that time. And I'm excited that we're going to have that kind of history setting moment.
So let's hold that up against something you referred to a few minutes ago, which is the Black and Brown Men's Roundtables, where you brought men of color together to talk about issues most relevant to them right now. It is also an exciting time for Black male leadership in the city. Whether you're thinking of Reverend Willie Bodrick, or you're thinking about Imari Paris Jeffries or Shigan Idowu, you've got Tito Jackson, you've got you. Talk about where Black male leadership in this city can go next and the role you want to play in that.
You know, I think it's one of the things that was part of the Black Men Roundtable conversation was the fact that women of color have done such an amazing job of organizing, of being part of the political conversation. What do you think about Stacey Abrams in Georgia and what's happening there? You think about our vice president. When you think about, locally here with Congresswoman Presley, there's just such great movement. But it's happened not just because we have amazing women who are running. It's happened also because there's been some organizing behind the scenes, whether it's the Barbara Lee Foundation or Emerge here locally and some of the other efforts to make sure that women, particularly women of color, get in the race and are part of the conversation and are organizing. And that's come to a crescendo. It's come to a real sort of point where people are so excited about it. Everybody's excited about it, right? And it's really become a movement in our country, which is beautiful and it's great. And so we said, some of us came around the table and said, look, let's be inspired by that. Let us begin to work with each other in that way where there is more organizing and more conversations about what Black men and men of color in general will bring to the conversation. What's our role? What do we do? How are we leaning into the moment and playing a leadership role and helping to create positive change in our city as a collective, not just as an individual, not just John by himself, not just, you know, Shagun by himself or Amari Paris Jeffries by himself, but as a collective, can we do some things that helps to shape the narrative in a different way, and it's helped to shape our place in a different way. And I think that's something that I'm excited about continuing with these, with Boston, with all of Boston, to figure out how we can have more of an impact.
Okay, so be a sage for a minute now. Not that you aren't always, but in this particular moment, what advice would you give to whomever is the next mayor, and what do they have to get done in those first 100 days or so?
You know, I think there are some tough conversations, not just in Boston, but in our country today. And the next mayor will need to, at the end of the day, be a coalition builder. We'll need to bring people together to have the tough conversations to make the kind of changes that you want to see happen. You know, in my work, whether it's in the community change-making work or in government reform work, you don't want to jam change down everybody's throat and create the kind of opposition that will then change it back as soon as they have power, right? I'm hoping that the next mayor is going to bring all stakeholders to the table and create lasting change in a way that it stays, right? It's sustainable and takes everybody's perspective into account and works for all of Boston. It's a moment here. It's a moment for change. Boston has an appetite for change, but let's make it work by creating a big tent and make that change something that's sustainable.
I'm going to ask you one question about Mass and Cass. We've talked about a lot of issues with you the last few times you've been on the show, but we just spoke with Catherine D'Amato from the Greater Boston Food Bank, who was really talking as essentially a local business owner and what the challenges are there. And that made me think of you as the former chief of economic development. With that hat on, what does that area need right now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's whether it's Catherine joining from the food bank or her neighbor right there, which is Food Pack, for-profit business that's helping small and to medium-sized restaurants throughout Boston by providing supplies, who has lost millions in business because they're at the epicenter of you know, what's happening on Mass and Cass today. We need to bring a sense of real urgency to this. I know I've said it during the campaign, and that means working with the folks down there, everyone, right? It's both the people who are in our cities looking for services and need health services so they can kick their habits and get their lives back on track. But it's also the businesses who are down there. It's the people who are trying to get to work. I can't tell you how many times I heard a story about workers who were trying to get to work or people trying to get to the food bank who, you know, got assaulted or chased or verbally, you know, abused. And people have lost, you know, faith a little bit. So people have not come back. And if you act, I don't know if Catherine talked about this at all, but she's lost some of her team members. And some of the for-profit businesses there have lost employees. And that's a sad thing. We need to bring a sense of urgency and begin to decentralize the services there immediately in order to make sure that that kind of, you know, human need isn't spilling out in the street and having that kind of effect in that neighborhood.
Okay, last question on the race. I got to ask you, are you going to endorse someone?
Those conversations are being had. I'm sitting with the candidates and having conversations. We'll see what happens. Are you going to endorse Tiziana?
Absolutely not.
No? I was hoping you'd endorse me. You never did. You know, hopefully one day we can talk about who you voted for.
Maybe not on air. Actually, I live in Newton. So, all right. That is former Boston mayoral candidate and chief of economic development, John Barrows. And John, I'm hoping you will come back on when you know what's next for you and tell us about it.
I appreciate it. Looking forward to doing that.
It is one of the most compelling unanswered questions in Boston's history, and now we may never know the truth. Who stole the artwork from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, and where is that artwork now? Bobby Gentile, the last living person of interest in the largest art heist the world has ever seen, and someone the FBI publicly identified as having had the paintings in his possession at one time, has died. His lawyer announced his death last night. He was 85. For the record, Gentile denied many times that he had any knowledge of who stole the artwork or where the masterpieces were.
How could they squeeze me? I don't know nothing. You know what I mean? Never seen the paintings, never did nothing with the paintings. Never even talked about the paintings.
Gentile was known in the world of organized crime as the cook. Here's Gentile's attorney, Ryan McGuigan.
I asked one person in the criminal underworld who I had, I guess, the pleasure of knowing. And his quote to me was, "Bobby Gentile, best damn sausage and peppers I ever had." And the second I heard that, I'm like, he's really the cook.
Authorities say that despite Gentile's denials, multiple informants were able to record him talking about the paintings and even bragging that he knew where to find them. One person who believes Gentile did know something about the stolen artwork is the Gardner Museum's chief of security, Anthony Amore.
If tomorrow there's a knock at the door at the museum and the Japanese Yakuza has our paintings, I would say, "How do you know Bobby Gentile? I've never in my life conversed with someone so willing to lie about things that were demonstrably true than him. He knows something and he will not tell us."
Now, all that incredible sound was part of WBUR and the Boston Globe's Last Scene podcast, which chronicled the Gardner heist and its investigation. It's well worth a listen. But now, joining us to talk about Gentile's passing is Anthony Amore, again, chief of security at the Gardner Museum and a prominent voice throughout the Last Scene podcast. Anthony, thanks for joining us on Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So the FBI thinks Bobby Gentile took at least some of the paintings from another member of the mafia in the parking lot of a main restaurant and transported them to Philadelphia. He maintained to authorities that he didn't, but you think he did. Why?
Well, I've seen more than my fair share of information that we've accumulated throughout the course of the investigation. I was part of all of the interviews with Mr. Gentile. I was part of his polygraph. I was there when he first interviewed with us. It's hard to put all of this information together, things that we found in his home, et cetera, and not believe that he had some connection to the heist.
And he failed his polygraph, correct?
As badly as one can fail one, yes.
What does that mean?
Well, the way polygraphs work is with an algorithm that tells you the likelihood of the person having been lying, and his scores were 99% and 99.9% likelihood of lying. And this is from open court records.
So do you think he was involved in the heist from the beginning, Anthony, as well as transporting the paintings? And do you think he knew where the paintings ended up?
I don't know exactly what his involvement was, and I don't think anybody does. This is the enigma of Bobby Gentile. We do know that he knew something, and it was something that most likely could have helped us, but he refused to provide that information. And along those lines, that one of the things I've heard repeatedly today, including the intro to this interview, is the idea of Bobby Gentile being the last living link, the last living person of interest, and that's just completely untrue. I don't know how this took life in the media a few years ago. Certainly not just you who says that, but it's not based in reality or fact. He is absolutely not the last living person of interest in the investigation.
So we're aware of him as what we thought was the last publicly identified living link. Are there other links that you can name that you either think or know remain of interest?
No, I think it would be incredibly improper for me to name any persons of interest or suspects publicly.
So
and it would be really detrimental to the investigation as well.
So what sense do you have of what it means for the investigation now that he has passed?
Well, there's a couple of things. First, to put it in a real basic way, the day before Mr. Gentile passed away, we were not working on an angle related to anything where he would have been relevant. So in other words, his passing doesn't change anything we're working on at the moment. But I would say, this has been really a key point, that when masterpieces are stolen and they're recovered generations later, and it's usually right away or generations later, it's because, in the latter case, someone who is either intimidating or threatening or scary has either become less so or has passed away. And as a result, information flows more freely. So it's not outside of the realm of possibility that someone might be less inhibited now with the fact that this maid member of La Cosa Nostra has passed away.
So that makes me think that you are still actively engaged with law enforcement on this investigation, and it continues to be ongoing?
Oh, absolutely. It's active and ongoing, and neither deterred or delayed by the passing of Mr. Gentile.
Why has it been so hard to solve this, Anthony?
Stolen art is drastically different than the other type of search that we're traditionally accustomed to, which is when you're looking for a fugitive or someone who's been kidnapped. In those instances, when you're looking for a human being, that person has to see doctors and I'm sorry for that.
Thanks.
Has to see doctors and has to go to the store and get food and such. But paintings stay where they're hidden, and they never emerge unless someone finds them or the holder gives them up. So they just sit there and wait, oftentimes in attics and crawl spaces and behind drywall and such, under people's beds, believe it or not. So paintings are not going to emerge on their own. You have to go get them.
And do you think these will eventually emerge, Anthony? And let's just pick, you know, in our lifetimes.
Oh, absolutely. I absolutely do. I've often said that if I thought that there was no hope, then I would leave the job because I'd be absolutely the wrong person for the museum to have as an investigator if I thought that they could never be found. I am as hopeful as ever and as determined as ever and optimistic that we will see these paintings in their frames where they belong at the Garden Museum again.
So what's the first thing you'll do on that day? The paintings are back in their frames at the Gardner Museum. Your odyssey of decades to find them is over. What's the first thing you do?
That's a great question. I think I can't imagine myself getting them back and seeing them on the walls and walking away from them. I'll spend hours just staring at every inch of them because all I've seen in my lifetime is reproductions. And I've often said that, I think your listeners would agree, there's no super high-res reproduction of a piece of art that compares to the piece of art in person. So I will just take them in for as long as, I'm the director of security, so I can stay as long as I want. So I'll be here.
Awesome.
All night looking at them.
All right, that's Anthony Amore, Chief of Security at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. Anthony, thanks for joining us. And listeners, again, you can check out the Last Scene podcast from WBUR and the Boston Globe. You can find a link at WBUR.org. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Tune in again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.